Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to this week's episode of the Legal Beagle Podcast. This week, we're going to talk to a special guest all the way from Oregon up in the Northwest about a slight change that the Oregon State Board of Bar Examiner is looking to make. And Blaine has a lot to say about that. He said it publicly. I was fortunate enough to invite him onto the show, and he's agreed to talk to you all about what's happening up there in Oregon. But the big change, for those non-attorneys that are watching, is that the bar exam is something that we all have to take when we graduate law school. I took two. Others have taken many more than that. But some don't want to take any. And that's what's happening in Oregon. There's this new movement that has passed muster, at least through the Oregon State Board of Examiners, to provide alternative solutions to taking the bar exam. Solutions maybe is the wrong word, Blaine, but it's alternatives to taking the bar exam. First of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I love your show. I've listened to a few of the episodes. And, you know, as I was listening to some of the episodes, one thing I haven't really had made clear, everybody in the legal profession always talks about starting a podcast, but you've done it. So how did you decide to get started with Legal Beagle?
Well, you know, funny, it was just by accident. And when I started, I'll tell you, I'm in a studio now with a lot of equipment. When I started, it was on my phone. It was literally an app on my cell phone, and I would sit there and record into my app on my own, just trying to educate people that would come to our website about the different areas of law that we practice in. Here I am over 100 episodes later, and we've evolved into having guests from throughout the country, like as far as Oregon, and I've had guests as far as the East Coast talking about all different things, not just related to personal injury law, but just related to law in general and that have some legal component. And so it's kind of just evolved over time into what it's become. It didn't intend to be what it is today, but now I sit in a studio with a lot of equipment and really good guests to educate our viewers.
Well, and that's kind of the nature of the beast. It sometimes things evolve, and good things usually do. So,
thank you for that.
And speaking of evolution, I'm all for evolving and improving. And the problem that I had fundamentally with some of the ideas as they're proposed is, and I sent you the link from the task force where they lay out the position that they've taken and the recommended alternatives that they're making. And they're not necessarily saying no more bar, because you would still have to sit for the bar if you wanted to be able to waive into other states. But they're saying if you want to only practice in Oregon, then we're going to offer you these alternate tracks in order to become a lawyer in good standing. So the way that this all started was with COVID, and there was concern about how people are going to be taking in-person tests. And it seemed to me that little effort was put into finding alternative ways for how that test might be conducted. So, for instance, you had a guest on the podcast a few episodes ago that sat for the Arizona bar remotely, and talking about that experience and having to sit in front of the computer and make sure that her face never left the computer screen. That was all a very interesting dynamic that she actually had to change her pattern and how she was doing her test taking in order to make sure that she was going to be in compliance with the rules. It's very interesting. But in Oregon, they didn't try to find an alternative at all. What they did was they said, we're going to offer a diploma privilege this year. So if you meet certain threshold requirements and you've gone to one of these schools, then you're going to automatically get the diploma privilege and automatically be practicing now. And after that happened, the Supreme Court, through the Chief Justice, set down a mandate and said, I'd like you to start a task force. And what I want the task force to do is to look at alternatives to the bar exam. And we've done this diploma privilege. Seems like, you know, maybe it's too soon to tell, but let's see if we can come up with some other alternatives. Now, it's my opinion that the alternatives that they came up with or that they found were using confirmation bias. So they wound up at the solutions first and then worked backward to justify why those would be great solutions, and then found supporting data, or it wasn't even data or statistics, that as you read through the report, there is no data, there are no statistics that they back up any of these findings with. But what they do is they present stuff with an error as if it is supported by authority, even though there is no authority for it. Because we're in a little bit of a brave new world here. I mean, this is a little bit different. We're post-COVID now. And we have to understand that certain things are probably going to evolve and change. But if at a fundamental level, what we're interested in is consumer protection and inclusion, which I'm for those two things, of course. We need to have minimum competency requirements. And that's been my position from the beginning. And I am for if your position is that the current bar exam poorly reflects what the accurate practice of the law is, I am in favor of changing the bar exam, how it's actually the questions or the test itself. But to remove the test entirely is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It doesn't make sense to me. And it doesn't just kind of this horse sense smell. It doesn't pass the smell test to throw that out. So that's been my position. I'm happy to dive into it deeper.
Yeah. Well, let's start back at the beginning. Why? And maybe the why you answered with the idea of what's happened with COVID in 2020, but why do this at all? I know there are a few states out there that have modified alternative paths towards practicing law. Why does Oregon feel like they need something?
So this is opinion, and I am not making any friends on my position, just so you know. I'm holding the minority position, but as we've seen throughout history, holding the minority position is not always the wrong place to be in. I mean, just look at Plessy v. Ferguson, and over time, minority positions become the majority. But I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen in this case necessarily. I think that they may ultimately come up with a reasonable alternative to what they've presented so far. But the why, in my opinion, is that we were seeing dwindling numbers of lawyers that were actually passing the bar. Or in the alternative, the Oregon State Bar is interested in increasing the number of bar members. And if you look at any organization, their number one goal generally is to increase their membership base. And that's the goal of, for instance, any business is growing its customer base. So growing your membership base increases the power of the group, increases the membership dues that are coming in. And if you see something dwindling, and you're wondering about why, and you say, well, there's this barrier to entry that's preventing people from getting into this system. Well, if we just remove that barrier to entry and make it easier to pass, then we'll have more members. Now, I've also seen the argument that bars are inherently classist or racist. Now, I would agree they're classist, and I put that in my position forward to the Supreme Court. But the classist, the way that they're classist, in my opinion, is it starts at the university level. And at the university level, the outrageous costs that you have to pay, not only for law school, but for undergrad, the amount of debt that you're saddled with. And like you, Jonathan, I did law school I didn't go straight from K to JD. So for us, when we were looking at law school, it's more of a business decision. How much is this going to cost me? And what is this going to entail on the back end? But there's plenty of folks who after undergrad go straight to law school because they need that upper level degree. For me at the time, when I first went to law school, it was to end up with that JD. It was between getting an MBA and a JD, and I wanted to continue down a track for business. I never anticipated sitting for the bar. It was just to get the JD. But if you're looking at overall the classist system, the point is that just to get into law school at an ABA accredited law school, which is what Oregon requires in order to sit for the bar, that is a steep hurdle. And like you, I didn't go straight to my school that I finished at. I finished at University of Oregon, but my first year of law school, I went to an ABA accredited school, but it was in Southern California. And that was because my LSAT scores weren't high enough to admit me into Oregon. And I had to get my grades up and prove that I belonged there, which I did ultimately. But that first school I went to was a bar prep type school. So they were preparing you to take the bar in California. But the classes system has to do with the cost of education. And if you want to increase the applicant base and increase the amount of people overall that are going to be admitted to take to be bar members, you have to increase that applicant base. So one way to do that would be to open up applications to people, not just that have passed from ABA accredited law schools, but from any law school. That's one way. Another way to do it would be you go to 1 year of ABA accredited law school, and then you intern or extern with a practicing attorney that's been practicing a certain amount of years. I don't know what that threshold would be, probably 5, 7, 8, 10. I don't know. But the point is that after you've apprenticed with them for long enough, then you can go sit for the bar. But in any event, you would still have to sit for the bar. That would open up more applicants potentially. But the racist part of it, I mean, if we look at the root definition of what racism is, generally, my definitions that I've read is it requires an active participation to resist an effort on a part of a specific race. But in Oregon, I'm not seeing the MPT, the MBE, the essay questions. Those, I haven't seen any statistical data that says that there is active discrimination preventing certain races from passing the bar. So I will not concede that point. I will concede the classes point, and there are remedies that I think that are worthwhile to explore. But again, to end with the two solutions, and I want to get into the two solutions and talk about why neither one of those will work. But I hope that answers a little bit more about my position on why we are where we are.
It does. And I have some thoughts that I'll share with you a little bit later, but I want to get into these two alternative pathways. One is the OEP, the Oregon Experimental Pathway, and the other is the SPP, the Supervised Practice Pathway. Can you explain to the listeners what each of those pathways are supposed to allow those that don't want to take the bar to have to do in order to become a licensed attorney?
So I can speak real broadly. So I want to make it clear, I'm by no means an expert. I don't work for the bar examiners. I did not work on this task force. In fact, I had no input to the task force. The task force did not reach out, I'm not aware, to any other attorneys other than people within their task force. Now, they might have, but nobody that I've talked to did they reach out to. And by the way, they could have sent out a survey to the Oregon State Bar members and said, what do you guys think about these proposed alternatives? That was not done. The first time that we heard about these alternatives was when the local bar came, and I'm in a remote area. I'm in Eastern Oregon and a pretty rural area. And they finally came out and visited us and told us that this is what they're proposing. They didn't ask. They told us that this is what we're going to be proposing. So the idea that they talked to stakeholders and took input is laughable if you read that report. But the experience, so one of the pathways, the way that I think about these, one of them is basically you have to graduate law school and then you're an attorney. Now they're going to give you this, curriculum that you have to, the first year of law school is still the same. You have to take your con law, you got to take your torts, you got to take your procedure. But that second year, you get to take these building block type courses. And ultimately, that work that you're doing in those specific courses is going to be reviewed by the Oregon State Board of Bar Examiners. And they're going to decide if your work is up to snuff and that you would otherwise now then be qualified to be an attorney. So that's basically track one. Track two, and this is real broadly. Obviously, these break down pretty significantly and a lot more. I'm sure people can explain this better than I, but this is just how I'm thinking about it. The second one is you sit and work with an attorney that's already licensed for so many years, and that same thing where you present your work over a period of time to the Board of Bar Examiners, and they would then grade it, review it, and decide if your work now meets the minimum competency standards to be an attorney. That's broadly speaking what those two alternatives are. The problem with the first alternative, and this is not to disparage anybody, but just about anybody, if they decide to, can go to school and get good enough grades to pass. And that should not be the minimum standard for being an attorney, in my opinion. It's not whether you graduated from law school. because in my opinion, most anybody can do that. And it's not to say that the bar exam is the right, is the ultimate. It's just the great equalizer that we have right now. But to say that all you would have to do is go to law school, anybody can, if you spend long enough on any project, you're going to get a good enough grade on it. If you have unlimited time, you can get a good enough grade on it. And that's essentially what that law school program allows you to do. And by the way, it would only be offered in Oregon. So you couldn't go to a school outside of Oregon and then be a part of that experiential path. The other thing that's interesting to think about is, and I don't know the answer to this, is why is it that they're recommending this experiential path program that only benefits university system? And I'm out here yelling from heaven on high saying the problem is the university system. And you guys are saying, no, we need to double down on the university system. And that's the way that we need to achieve this outcome of getting more attorneys, is we need to rely on the university system. And I'm saying, no, that's not the answer. The answer is to open it up, free market. We need more schools. We need more people applying to take the bar, not less, not people that only go to Oregon. And then the problem with the secondary program primarily is that if you're, anybody knows that if you're working with an experienced attorney, they already have all the forms that you need. And I don't think that there's anybody, I mean, any paralegal or experienced legal assistant can work with those forms that an attorney has and get pretty darn close. Now, it takes the attorney to give a final review and make sure that everything's correct. But to say that I'm going to use another person's forms and be an attorney at the end of so long because I've used their forms, I think is fallacious reasoning. So,
yeah, it's funny. We have very similar paths towards where we sit today. And one of those is starting at a school that is now defunct. It was ABA accredited when I started there. It is no longer ABA accredited, and it's out of business. And the reality of that is mainly due to the fact that a lot of the people that I went to school with, and then those that came after me, because this was a private law school, so it was really about the money that they were receiving from the students that went to school there. Everyone passed. I knew very few people that actually failed law school, but a lot of those people failed the bar. In fact, their bar passage rate was so low. That's one of the reasons the ABA pulled their accreditation. So to your point about just simply going to law school and passing law school, that is a very dangerous proposition to put into the public. And if one of their, and I was reading in the report, one of OSB's claims is that they want more accessibility and more equity in the legal profession. This is in the task force report that you sent to me. I think there's that consumer protection's out the door. If your real concern is we want educated and intelligent attorneys practicing law, serving the impoverished or the underserved, but you're saying, hey, we're going to allow private institutions and even public ones for the sake of argument that really push students through the educational process to their JD. And you essentially through this OEP program can become an attorney without having to ever sit for the bar. That would take, and you know, Blaine, if I'm being honest, that I don't know the actual numbers, but I think a 2/3 of the students that were at Phoenix School of Law, the school that's now out of business that I started at, and make them attorneys that were not equipped to become attorneys if you use the bar exam as that great equalizer, because they just simply didn't pass.
And I assume that the people are going to say that I'm not defending this vigorously enough, that the Oregon State Bar Examiners are still going to review that work and there's going to be another safeguard in place. But the reality is that if you have unlimited time to do anything, you're going to get good enough that you can pass. And I agree, it's a dangerous precedent to set. Now, I do want to talk about something more broadly, which is this idea of equity, inclusion. I've heard people take the position when they hear my minority position that we should basically, if something's not broke, don't break it. You don't necessarily have to come back as a task force with proposed alternatives. You could have said, hey, the system that we have in place is not perfect, but we don't have a better solution at this point, and we're just going to stand pat. To feel like you have to come back with an answer, I think was the wrong mindset for them to have started with. But if you start from the position of inclusion and equity, and you say, look, there's a lot of people that go to law school and they're not going to be a trial attorney. You practice personal injury. I practice personal injury. I practiced as a prosecutor for 7.5 years, and I did a lot of trial work. I'm a trial attorney at this point. And there's a lot of people on the other side of it that say, I know I'm never going to do a trial. I am only going to be a paper pusher. I am only going to do transactional law. And that's the argument that I hear as the counter about when I say that the bar is the great equalizer and you need to do something under time conditions, the pressure test, where you have to regurgitate this information in a high stress environment. Because if you take the hardest part of being an attorney, it's going to trial and it's sitting in front of that judge or jury, that fact finder, and having to regurgitate your case to them in a way that is the most compelling case that you can possibly make. That's one of the most stressful things that you can do as an attorney. The best way that they've found to mimic that or mirror that is through the bar. There is no other way that they found so far that can even closely approximate it. So, but for those people that say, okay, but I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to do a trial and I'm never going to have that level of stress. Well, in the olden days or the olden times where we're derived from, there was barristers and solicitors, right? And I'm sure you're aware of this because they kind of make you learn it when you first start law school. But you've got the barristers and you've got the solicitors. So the barristers, I believe, are the advocates, and the solicitors are the ones that actually sit and they do everything up until the point of trial. And then the barristers are the trial advocates that actually are going into court and being the trial attorneys. So I could see a situation where the Oregon State Board of Bar Examiners said, look, that old way that they used to do it, they actually had it right in the first place. There is a distinguishing characteristic between up to the point of trial and then after you file. And then after you file, that case is just fundamentally different when it's in a trial posture. And at that point, you need to be a certain threshold of an attorney and sit for this bar exam. But if you're just going to be a solicitor and all you're going to do is paper pushing, then I could see a situation where they say, okay, well, you're not certified to go into court or do anything post filing, but you can do all these areas of law. And it could be administrative law. You could carve out a whole bunch of areas of the law. And certainly, there's a lot of lawmakers in Oregon. It wouldn't be very difficult to enumerate a bunch of statutes that say these are the areas of law that solicitors are now able to practice within. If you take this course within the law school program, you're approved by the bar examiners, you're now a solicitor. I suppose that would be one way that you could get toward inclusion. There's other ways that I think you could get toward inclusion too. I don't know why they couldn't have asked more people for these types of solutions or even have explored these types of solutions rather than just coming up with, we need to give the universities ultimately more money and have them be the solo track for becoming an attorney, or we need to just avoid people taking the bar altogether because somehow it's not fair to require people to pass the bar, which doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, you look at a lot of different other professions and there's some licensing requirement and some threshold you need to meet. And I noticed in researching this, you know, the ethics exam that we all have to take, the MPRE, is not being removed from this requirement that you would still need to complete in order to choose the alternative pathways if they become an option there in Oregon. And I thought that was a little bit interesting because I'm like, you're trying to eliminate the bar exam, but why does the MPRE still then? That's a uniform exam. I understand it's in a different topic about ethics, but it's still uniform in the sense that it's still an exam that has a pass-fail to it. And people do fail the MPRE. So how do you square those two things? Meaning you're not taking away all standardized exams. You're just simply taking away the more difficult, more intense exam and saying, okay, here are some ways that you can still practice, but you're not eliminating all exams. You're not eliminating the MPRE and saying you don't have to take any exams. You just have to go to law school, get your JD, and do some practice coursework or have some supervision from an attorney and you become licensed. What are your thoughts regarding that distinction where they're not taking away another uniformed exam that is still required?
Well, that's a great question. So the problem is usually my positions are contrary or can be contrary to kind of what the woke mob is interested in. And I say, I'm not woke, but I'm awake. And part of the issue here is that they're getting rid of the things that are hard. and they don't want to do things that are hard. But the MPRE, yes, it's pass fail, but if you do some minimum level of studying, it's not that difficult. The other issue is that there is a optics question. And if you take away a portion of becoming an attorney that's an ethics portion, then what you're doing essentially is you're saying, we know that attorneys are not ethical, or they have this stigma of being unethical that attorneys lie, or, you know, we know, we've heard all the old jokes. So, but to take away that ethics portion would be a joke, and they know it. So they can't remove that part. They can't. And also, if we look at this, everything, every major change happens incrementally. And the way that this happened was it became the exception to the rule by COVID, where they were doing a diploma privilege this year. And if you give them a little bit of room, if you give them a little bit of scope creep, they're going to gobble up the earth in front of you. And that's just the way that it is. So yeah, they're saying for now, MPRE remains a place. Doesn't mean that they're not going to throw it out later. It's just what they proposed at this time. It's the same reason in Oregon, we don't have a sales tax. And the reason we've never had a sales tax, in my opinion, is because they don't, they always propose it as some small incremental amount. They say, you know, it's just going to be a half a percent or a percent. You know, you won't even notice it as you're buying your groceries. But you look at other states with sales tax, that's how they all started. They all started low, and then they creep. So that's the same thing they're doing here. It's death by a thousand cuts. They're going to get you slowly but surely. And by the way, me yelling and hollering, it doesn't change anything. The Oregon State Bar is still not the bar, but the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court Justice, they're still going to do whatever they're going to do. And I'm just going to be on record as saying, you guys were wrong on this, and you got it wrong. And that's the only, the point that I'm trying to make with all of this, is that there are alternatives, and the MPRE is not a fundamental flaw of part of this, but your reasoning is fundamentally flawed. So
what's the goal here? I mean, the goal, I know you said in the beginning, you talked about more attorneys and the idea of bolstering membership for the state bar, but you referenced this in the op-ed that you wrote, and that was about, let's serve the underserved. Let's find ways to provide more resources. I can't think, as I spent a lot of time reading and working on preparing for this podcast with you, I can't see how just simply giving people an easier path towards practicing law does or accomplishes that goal. Like, I don't see it. I don't see how one equals two there. I don't see how you go from, we've given, there are more people now in the marketplace, so therefore, I guess by default, some of those people will serve the underserved. Like, that seems to be a problem. You reference it, but I'm trying to understand why. Not just the why, but the how this is going to become practical and actually help people that need legal resources that maybe can't afford those.
I don't know the answer to that. This is kind of the problem, is what I say in my piece, is that I'm out here in rural Oregon. People are retiring and nobody's backfilling these positions. And we are just getting more and more inundated with work. And I don't complain. You know, the sun is shining. I'm making hay. We're plenty busy. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it would sure be great to have more attorneys out here that had passed the bar coming out here and taking on some of this caseload for us, because we need it. There's people that are poor, they're impoverished, they're in a rural community, and they need your help. And the Oregon State Bar has a modest means program to their credit, and it does, but only so many attorneys are going to apply for that. And only so many attorneys can afford that to do at a cut rate type of a price and provide those services. I don't know how you get to that goal and that objective by doing this, because what I would say is, if you want to put somebody as a through one of these tracks, then and not that this would make a huge difference, because again, I mean, just look at the case with I don't know if you heard about that case with West Coast BP, where, and by the way, that case went up to appeal. The basic summary is that the ARCO stations were not advertising the 35-cent surcharge that they were doing on every debit card purchase when you would go to the ARCO station. And there was a class action lawsuit that was started in Oregon, and successful at the trial level and said that you were misleading in your advertising. In fact, BP told the stations, do not advertise the 35-cent fee. And so it was something like a $405 million judgment that was earning $100,000 in interest a day while the case was on appeal. And there's an attorney out here in rural Eastern Oregon that was one of the lead attorneys on that appeal case. And the other lead attorney was David Sugarman. But ultimately on appeal, that they won on appeal and they ended up settling so that they didn't have to go any further, which was a huge win for the class action. Everybody around Oregon that had participated in that litigation got something like $263 or something like that. But that's there's a couple of points from that story to take away. One is that one of the lead attorneys on that appeal was an attorney out here that chose to live in Eastern Oregon. But part of that is getting to the standard of how do we ensure that we're getting that level of competency that we need. So if we have a system where one of these attorneys has gone through one of these tracks, for instance, that they're proposing, and there was an asterisk next to their name, like they proposed in baseball at one time for the steroids era, that they wanted to put asterisks next to all those numbers. If you want to put an asterisk next to somebody's name and say, this is not really a person that passed the bar, but they went through the law school system program. So yes, they can handle your work for you, but they don't earn as much per hour as a trial attorney would. I don't know. I'm thinking out loud, because how else do you delineate for the consumers that, honestly, this is my opinion, this is not a real lawyer. This is not somebody that's gone through the pressure test of a bar exam and may not be well suited if your case goes to trial. And this is not to say, by the way, that every attorney that's passed the bar is an exceptional attorney. I know plenty of attorneys that pass the bar that are not necessarily exceptional attorneys. I think we all know examples of that. But it is the system that we have in place. So I don't know how you get to consumer protection. That's one of my biggest concerns, is because the thing that they said that they were focusing on throughout this paperwork is, we're interested in inclusion, inclusion, inclusion. But it's at this point, it's at the expense of the consumer, who has no idea how to differentiate between one of these attorneys that's gone through one of these alternative tracks and somebody that sat for the bar.
I totally agree. I think if you had some sort of indicator that would delineate a limited practicing attorney or something that the consumer could easily identify with that says, oh, okay, this is a person who went through the traditional methods of becoming an attorney. This is someone who took an alternate path, and then I can buyer beware kind of thing. I also think it would be fascinating if under the OEP or the SPP, if there was a requirement that part of the coursework or supervised work happened in a underserved area, as opposed to it can just happen anywhere. I see such a recipe for disaster in the SPP program for big law firms that are looking to take advantage of people, or even big mill law firms that even do personal injury, that could push people through this system without actually really giving them any sort of supervised practice. And you're not then meeting that goal of inclusion. You're certainly not providing equity in the marketplace. You're not giving the state what it really is hoping to achieve. And so then I looked a little deeper at this report, and I started to wonder, and this is my conspiracy theory, and again, I'm just an outsider looking in, but I wonder if this is really just a boon for OSP and really for the state bar as a whole. And I'll point to a paragraph, Blaine, in page 3 of the report, where it talks about these recommendations, and it says, both of these alternative pathways will rely heavily on volunteer support from the Oregon legal community. But even with an ample volunteer support, they will create significant additional work for the admission staff of OSB. It is likely that if the court approves these alternatives, the admissions department will require additional staff or technology upgrades due to the increased work. And it goes on to talk about all this additional money that needs to be poured into OSB in order to support these new programs. And I just started to, it just, this light kind of clicked, and I was like, is this really about providing better legal resources to the community, or is this about creating a bigger membership, which generates more fees, because there's a fee to be a part of the state bar, and really providing more resources to OSB, who is looking to upgrade and become a little bit more powerful themselves. I'm way out on a limb, I know that. But I just read that and I was like, what's the real rub here? What are we really trying to accomplish here? Because it doesn't seem like these solutions do what the OSB is saying the reason for these solutions are. Like, I don't, and maybe I'm doing a poor job of explaining that, but I don't see that it's like this this contradiction in the report itself. We want these things to be accessibility and equity, and we want to, you know, protect consumers, and but then you don't really see that these pathways do those things. They don't serve that purpose. And that's where I think I'm a little skeptical of these two programs and these two pathways. You know, I sat for the Arizona bar, and then I sat for the California bar. California bar at the time was a 3-day exam. It's now a 2-day exam. So I joke with people that when they take the California bar, they're not taking the real bar exam anymore. I will tell you that, Blaine, on the way to the third day of the California bar, I was taking it with a friend who unfortunately did not pass. I said, this is where we win or lose the bar. And he said, why? I said, because this is the day where your mental attrition is going to have to outpace everyone else because you have to be so dialed in. And I myself have done trials, and just like you, when you get into day 3, 4, 5, 6 of trial, you start to wear down and you have to be prepared to go through that gauntlet in order to have a successful outcome. And I think I think these alternatives are stripping those attorneys that do hope to practice and do trial work or get into the courtroom and do high intense stressful work of that experience. Because once you do it at a bar exam level, I think you're more equipped to do it in practice. And I don't disagree with you. I think there are, look, I know licensed attorneys that are maybe shouldn't be licensed attorneys, but I think that is a small percentage of people. I think the majority of people that get to this point that pass the bar exam are equipped to practice law. And I think you're taking away that component when you provide these alternatives. I certainly feel similar to you do. And I worry that if this program gets adopted by the state of Oregon, you're going to see this cascading effect in other states. And we may see this come down to Arizona, may eventually end up in California or elsewhere. And I know there are alternatives in other states, and they're already doing some of these things in Wisconsin and New Hampshire and Utah. But it's something that it troubles me. And it's why I wanted to talk to you about this, because I actually appreciate you raising your hand and saying, look, I don't think this is the wisest decision, guys. I think there's something that needs to be considered beyond what you guys are trying to do. So, you know, I don't know what will come of this. Can you just, we talked about this briefly before we jumped on the podcast. Where do we stand right now in Oregon with this situation? Because OSB, the Oregon State Board of Examiners has recommended this to the Supreme Court, these alternative pathways. Where is it in terms of the Supreme Court making a decision?
So right now, my understanding is it's still under review by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is the decider of whether or not these changes are going to be implemented or not. It's not the Board of Bar Examiners. The Board of Bar Examiners and this task force has proposed these alternatives. That link that I sent you with the Oregon or with that task force report also has a place for public comment. And what I would appreciate is if your show notes or something, you could put a link to that report where it has the place for the public comment so that other folks that are sitting out and listening to this can go and make public comment about what they think about it. And what I've been trying to encourage everybody to do is, even if you agree with it, even if you disagree with me or you agree with me, I don't really care. The point of this is that you go out and you make your opinion known and you state your comments publicly. You've said a lot of things actually in this this last go around that are really interesting, and you made some really good points. And there's a couple of things I want to come back to. So that idea where you might set up folks in different geographical areas on part of this externship process. Obviously, us in our remote areas, we would love that. There's, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about other ways that that could also be accomplished. So what if it was a system where you had to get so many, what if it was more like a doctor and you had to go through so much residency and you had to do that before you became an attorney, or that was a pathway, but you had to do it in a impoverished community pro bono? I mean, there are other ways to achieve this, and we're just spitballing here. I haven't even given it, I've been thinking about it because it's frustrating me, but I haven't given it as much thought as the task force had for a year or however long they were contemplating it. And we're coming up with these ideas that seem all much better than what they've proposed. you know, in the, I'm thinking back to this term that I learned in con law, where they talk about that a solution has to be narrowly tailored and reasonably related. And as you're talking about those two alternatives, they're neither of those things. They're neither narrowly tailored nor reasonably related to the practice of law. And I just happen to agree that I can't find another reason about why they're trying to do it. Now, if it was the case that you opened up the application pool so that more people were able to apply, and that inundated them with a ton of people, and they had to expand the amount of people that were working for the Oregon State Bar, and ultimately that led to more qualified candidates ultimately being accepted in the bar system, I'd obviously be fine for that. But what they're trying to do is lower the bar, the minimum bar, to pass, which doesn't make any sense.
I agree. And I think one of the challenges here, and we had a recent change here in Arizona that's a little different than what you guys are experiencing in Oregon, but there was a lot of public comment. There were a lot of chatter through the plaintiff's bar about this idea. It was the idea of non-attorneys now being able to own law firms and share in the profits of law firms. That I think it was one of the first in the nation to do this, where the Supreme Court said, yeah, we're going to go ahead and approve this. What I appreciated about the process, and I think you said it at the beginning of your op-ed, and I love this, Blaine. You said, I love that I live in a country where I can make my opinion known without fear of, you know, some sort of repercussion. And I agree. I wasn't on the right side of what happened here, but I felt confident in making my opinion public and talking about it and advocating for the position I was supporting. And I do appreciate the fact that we do live somewhere where we can do that without, you know, some sort of fear of retribution and something bad happening. I don't know why more people don't stand up. You should not be the only one. And frankly, Blaine, in my research, you're the only one I can find publicly that is making a comment about this yeah, new recommendation. I don't know why there aren't more people. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, because why would you want to make a comment on something that's inevitable? You're just going to be on the wrong side of the decision. I'm not making any friends. Like the people that are in power are not going to like what I'm saying. And ultimately, when this goes through, because in some form or fashion, I'm going to lose. I'm just going to be a voice that's out here in the wind, and it's going to evaporate into nothing. But yeah, I made that point about that we live in a country where I'm free from threat of reprisal. I am not afraid that the bar is going to reprimand me. They're not going to treat me any differently if anything ever comes up. It's never going to result in an ethics complaint or anything like that. They're just not going to do that. And by the way, the reason they're not going to do that is because I'm being so vocal about it. So now I'm on record. And if they do anything, then I'm just going to play this audio back and say, they're only doing this because I spoke out against them and the things that they're saying. But I don't know. I get the feeling that when people see that it's inevitable, I mean, there's another example that happened here recently in Oregon. There was a measure that passed, which was called 110. And it essentially, they said it decriminalized hard drugs. And the way that they positioned it was this like 18-page bill that they passed, which they said was to increase the ability for people to go to rehab centers. And that was the whole crux of it. So in Oregon, we passed legal marijuana. So recreational marijuana is legal in Oregon. And part of the way that they passed that was they said at a local level, the cities have to allow it to be sold. Everybody can use it throughout the state. You can possess a certain amount. But if you're going to sell it locally, it has to pass a local measure. And if it passes a local measure, it has to include the tax, has to include the regulations that are required under the OLCC, which is the Oregon Liquor Commission Control Board. So that brings in quite a bit of revenue. Just like any liquor sales, marijuana sales brings in a large amount of money. So what they said was under this measure 110 was we're going to divert some of that tax fund that's coming in from that marijuana money, and we're going to use it to build these rehab centers. But by the way, at the same time, we're going to legalize methamphetamine, or not legalize. It's essentially legalized, but we're going to decriminalize methamphetamine, fentanyl, heroin, cocaine, all the big ones. We're just going to make them so you can walk around with a gram and it's $100 ticket. And they don't even write the tickets for it anymore, because the way that you have to, the steps, and I'm going to give a lot of this away at this point, but how do you prove in a violation case, which is by preponderance of the evidence, that the substance you were in possession of was in fact the substance that they're alleging that you had? They would have to do a test, a NIC test or a NARC test, in order to prove that the substance was what it was. Those tests cost more than the $100 ticket. And also, if you get the $100 ticket, you can call in and make an appointment to get an analysis for your addiction level or whatever. And my understanding is you call in, you go, yeah, I use a gram of meth a day. And they go, well, yep, you're an addict. You should probably get into treatment. And that's it. And then you don't have to pay your $100 ticket. And I don't know what the statistics are on how many tickets they've handed out so far, but The fundamental flaw with Measure 110, aside from the fact that the way that they got it to pass was outside money, because at the time, Oregon had unlimited money that you can spend on campaigns. There's no limit. So a bunch of money came in from outside donors to really promote this law that should be passed. And they all focused on, we're gonna rehabilitate people. We are going to treat addiction. But the reality is, it's just going to get worse, because the only way to treat this addiction at this level, I worked as a prosecutor for 7.5 years. I have stories of folks where they thank you afterward for holding them accountable, for getting them a probation officer, for having them go to check-ins, to having to do UAs, to having to go to treatment and classes in order to get themselves back on the straight and narrow. The only person that can decide to make a change for an addict is an addict. They have to fundamentally decide that they want to change. And most of the times that addicts are in the throes of addiction, they're not capable of making that decision at that time. The only way to correct that behavior is to pull them out of it and to force them out of it. There's this great documentary called Seattle is Dying. And it's on YouTube. It's available. I'd encourage anybody to watch it. It proposes alternatives that I think were done in Rhode Island, I want to say, to stem some of these problems that they were having with the controlled substance issue over there. It's a great documentary, but Measure 110 does nothing for helping those that are addicted to controlled substances to get the help they need. I haven't seen one place go up. I haven't seen one additional center be available to people that are struggling with addiction. And people do struggle with addiction. But the other part of this, and everybody who's worked in prosecution or defense knows that the real issue is it's a dual diagnosis issue. And almost every time we have hand in hand with this addiction, we have a mental health issue. And we can't have one without the other. It's like peanut butter and jelly. They're almost always together. But the point that I'm making is that this scope creep, some would argue, happened over time, where you're legalizing marijuana. They also then legalized recreational mushrooms, I believe, or psilocybin or whatever it's called. And then eventually you got this Measure 110, where we're basically New Amsterdam and everything's fair game. And I wouldn't be surprised if people in Washington are just driving people over the border and saying, you can't do it over here, but you go on over into Oregon and it's free reign over there. Oregon is not setting a great example for anything right now, in my opinion. They're not doing it with 110. They're not doing it with the way that they're passing the laws. They're not promoting inclusion. They're not helping anybody. They're not opening more mental health centers. The mental health center in Oregon is overloaded. If you look at the criminal justice system, there is no help for the people that need mental health treatment. And it's just broken. It's a broken system. And somebody needs to address that. Don't focus on these things. Focus on fixing the things that are on fire. Stop trying to fix things that aren't broke. This is not broke. Like, go take these experienced attorneys that are out there with that need work to do and go focus on that issue. Or if you want to be a legislator and you want to say inclusion, 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 how about the mental health people that can't speak for themselves? Go help them. But that's another soapbox. It's frustrating, the things that you get to see on a regular basis that nobody else seems to give a care about.
Yeah. You know, for those that think that I find guests that are in alignment with my own viewpoints, I don't. I just happen to agree with a lot of things that Blaine is saying. I did reach out to Joanna Perini Abbott, who is the chair of this alternative task force. She did not respond. If you watch this, Joanna, you're still welcome to come on and be a guest. I'd love to talk to you about how you look at these two alternative pathways as responsible alternatives to the bar exam in the state of Oregon. But Blaine, I can't thank you enough for coming on this podcast and sharing your opinions and your thoughts on the inadequacy of these two alternatives and why they don't necessarily achieve the goals that the Oregon State Bar is hoping to achieve. Once this passes, will you keep me posted on, or I shouldn't say once this passes. I know we're both assuming that some form of this is going to pass. Once the Supreme Court makes some sort of decision, will you let me know what that is so that I can apprise our viewers and listeners about what has ultimately happened in Oregon?
Of course. Yeah, of course I will, Jonathan.
Thank you for coming on, Blaine. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Thanks for getting this. I know that you're saying that it's a different point of view, but like I was saying at the beginning, it's some of this is just horse sense. You could just go down the street and ask anybody what they think on, hey, should we just remove the bar altogether? And they would look at you and say, what are you talking about? Every single major profession, architects, nurses, they all have to take a minimum competency test. You want to remove that? It just doesn't make any sense.